Welcome to VR in Education.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting episode of VR in Education, where we dive deep into virtual reality for teaching and learning. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Jonathan Teske, who's the founder and CEO of Reframe XR. Jonathan's been a pioneer in the XR education space. He was product manager and the future for education lead at Meta for over 4 years. Jonathan has also worked for Discovery Ed as a product manager and was a highly accomplished math and ESL leader. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you. You're very kind with those, but I appreciate it. I'm really super excited to be here.
Yeah. And one of the things before we get into the origin story question that I really appreciate about you is you've been a teacher, and sometimes ed tech companies and ed tech startups don't get that part. And I'm just so thankful that I get to talk to someone who has been a teacher and knows then a little bit about that side of the coin when it comes to trying to deploy a solution for the classroom. So kudos to you.
I appreciate it. I think those lived experiences are often misunderstood or overlooked in the tech/business world. So I really appreciate you calling that out, as it's, I still feel like it's something I have to come up against. But I think when I get to have conversations with educators like yourself and others, there is a sense of familiarity that really breaks down the conversation, and we actually get to the core crux of either what we're talking about or the problems we're trying to solve, whether that's an XR or something else. It goes a long way. So I appreciate that.
Let's do our origin story. What got you interested in, and let me throw some acronyms out there. You know, I often say VR, but we're going to talk beyond VR. We're going to talk about mixed reality, a little AR, but what got you interested, excited about, let's just say, XR, extended reality?
Yeah, I think it started with, primarily as a lifelong gamer, it definitely started with Virtual Boy. And maybe I'm dating myself, but the Virtual Boy was the first time I had ever experienced VR. And it was only at, you know, one of those like Sears kiosks back in the day. I never got to own one, which I think goes along with the age old, you know, VR is something you're going to want before you can afford. And I think that carried through for 20 more years, where the next phase was, I think, the Nintendo Wii, where a lot of experiential gaming at least came in, and to an extent, some forms of learning, casual or otherwise. And then I think seeing the Oculus Rift, again, something I wanted but could never afford as an educator back in the day, all of those led up to when I finally joined then Facebook, was prior to the Quest 1 launch at the beginning of that year. So for almost the full year, I got to be what we call internally a dog fooder. So I get to just test and try. And I think within 2 weeks of joining the company, I signed up. You know, we were in the Oculus building where my team was. So I signed up right away and just held on to that thing for as long as I could, kept checking it out, test and dog food, and just felt like it was both the future in general as technology, but also an impact in education in different ways. So kind of a bit of a journey, but I do think it always starts, I think a lot of us start with it, with gaming. And then for those of us in the education realm, we're always like, but this could work in education too. It's just how you approach that sentence, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I mean, we can look at all sorts of different tech tools. And what you said at the end there, it's how you approach it that is key. And we're going to unpack that in great detail today. But, you know, the failure of a tech tool has little to do with the tech tool itself. It's about, like you said, how is it effectively deployed? And I'm excited to talk to you more about that. One of the things that really caught my eye when I was doing my homework and research on you was something you had on LinkedIn. So in your profile, it said that you were wanting to solve ambiguous and challenging XR problems in education by identifying creative and inclusive solutions. So give us, having said that, give us a high-level overview of what Reframe XR is all about and how are you solving some of those problems?
I think from an ambiguity perspective, I would say, you know, given that I think we start with research. Let's start with research, right? Especially in VR. It's mixed. There are some goods and bads. We tend to cherry pick. And I think, you know, from a VR perspective, and I think specifically within, we'll say, the aged 10 to 18 range, we tend so far to use a lot of adult learning theory that has been tested and somewhat proven in VR, and then say, hey, well, I think that'll work with kids because they love gaming or they love immersive or immersive experiences. I think there's a lot of ambiguity still in that phrase. And so with Reframe, we sought out to do two big things, which was the ambiguity around how teachers are willing to use headsets in their classrooms, I think is still quite ambiguous. And a lot of the feedback in the research that we did while at Meta and in the past year getting Reframe off the ground was really focused on listening to educators be frustrated that they loved the technology, they thought it was the future, they know their students to an extent love it or are interested, but not really recognizing where it fits into their world. And what it really meant, you know, to me, having reflected long enough as a former educator, was where do I see myself in my classroom with this technology? And so with Reframe, we wanted to make sure we built a tool that specifically served the educator first, that then can be passed on. Those kind of learning and accessibility savings can then be passed on to students if you serve the teacher the right way and start about their behaviors of the way they think spatially already and have thought spatially for decades with or without headsets, physical world, and how we can port those behaviors to the technology as opposed to bring the technology in. And what VR, I think, has done a lot is changed behaviors. And again, going back to the beginning of this answer is the research is mixed on whether that is good or bad. And so for me, it was listening to a bunch of experiences going, hey, the teacher needs some kind of tool to have agency when they design the room. So part one is teachers get to design the room spatially inside a headset. So making sure that they have agency if they're in a headset, because most of the times we heard, and I continue to hear, teachers don't want to be in headsets. And I get that, right? I think there's not just an acceptance barrier to having that, but there's also a safety barrier to having a teacher in a headset that still has pretty strong occlusion and small field of view when they're in charge of and responsible for, you know, 25 to 30 kids in a classroom. So making sure if they're in a headset, they have agency, it's short form, they get to build their classroom and then get out of the headset and can have a platform that then enables them to manage that spatial classroom without having to put a headset on if they don't want to. And then secondly was helping them then deploy content that just frankly just felt like magic to students, whether that was in single or multiplayer mode, or we'll call it shared spatial computing, or we'll call it co-located mixed reality, whichever fence you're on. But it was to help the teacher enable, or I guess re-enable, if we come from the VR world, is a strong amount of collaboration, meaning-making, discourse that I just think is kind of lost. And we could talk about that more broadly. I'm a language teacher, so it is independent of technology. But I do think VR exacerbates that. So we wanted to kind of break down a lot of that friction and barrier for the teacher, knowing that that would be passed on in better experiences for students. And developers making those experiences. Mm.
And one of the neat things that becomes the center point of the stations that students see within the classroom that the teacher has set up is 3D assets or models that become the center point of conversation and discussion. And so these are akin, for those that maybe haven't seen sort of a promo video like I have, and also I've been lucky enough to try it out myself. You know, this might be like an earth that is rotating and spinning amongst a group of students all in headsets, but see the physical room but the digital 3D asset or object. So my first question to push the boundaries on your thinking is, teachers can grab their phone or iPads within the classroom, and they could already produce a AR 3D object that a student could look from the lens of an iPad. How is this different in your eyes, and what is Reframe trying to do that amplifies this?
I think it comes from the flexibility of being in a headset frees you from kind of looking through a window. And that's what I think about the strong difference. I think from an accessibility and scalability perspective, we should not let go of those tablets and phones for a while. But I do think that really limits your interaction types and the immersion to an extent. You know, and immersion is different for different learners and different people. The cognitive load of immersion is also important to take into account. And so from an accessibility standpoint, those devices should stay and be used. However, what you gain from being in a headset is your hands, your arms, your body. And I think those, and kind of what we talk about, you know, kinesthetic learning, experiential learning, all of those new affordances come to you when you're no longer having to use at least one hand to just hold a device. And then your limited inputs typically come from tapping or pinching and zooming. And so I think with being in a headset that we want to support to start with, and that kind of shared mixed reality experience goes broadly across different types of learning, which it could be in this case, you talked about kind of one of our climate lessons that we made, a short form climate lesson, all the way to, you know, working with mixed reality firefighter training to learning music production. All of those things are kind of, when they're in a tablet or a phone, they're distilled down to types of learning, or not learning, but they're learning, but types of experiences that don't feel fully real. And maybe that is subjective. But you know, if I would love to learn how to produce music, I think about immediately going into a studio or going to a college for music education, as opposed to potentially, you know, and getting to work at a soundboard that has those hundreds of dials, you know, and the frequency charts. It's kind of hard to distill that down into an iPad or tablet experience. So I think us being able to provide developers the flexibility to deliver that more succinctly and quickly to their chosen, you know, educational customer, but also giving students just more affordances, you know, in that experiential learning, I think is a key differentiator.
You used the term shared learning, and I want to unpack that more, because I firmly believe, having taught for so many years, that learning should be a social event. So if we're able to discuss, debate, build relationships around learning with others, you know, I can't help but think of, you know, there's a discussion protocol that is widely known and widely used amongst teachers, simple yet effective. It's called Think, Pair, Share.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, Think, Pair, Share basically says, like, we've got to be able, in a classroom that has many people, to ruminate and learn from each other. Whereas many virtual reality experiences that are educational right now, not all, but many, are single, solitary events. It's just you inside the headset, and there's some merit to that. But like I said before, there's tons of educational research out there to say, you know, learning is, as I said before, a social event. However, the nuances of creating a positive learning event that involves other students can be tricky. So in your app, you're orchestrating that around, as I said earlier, a central 3D asset, students are in a group. How would you suggest that positive learning happens when we put kids around this 3D asset in a group so that they're on task?
Well, I think that question, actually, you could just strip away the headset, and it's still thinking about scaffolds, differentiators, language stems. And again, coming from, you know, my language background, thinking about the four domains of language, I don't know if we do a great job helping learners reinforce all four domains. We tend to be a very written and reading, you know, world in terms of standardized testing. But we know that the spoken and the listening domains are really powerful for adapting. And so I think just regardless of technology, I do think both from a developer perspective, thinking about and empathizing with a teacher that has to build those experiences in, they can either be built into the experience. And again, we don't care what the developer builds. We want to help them build it faster and better in terms of if it is a single or multiplayer experience. But I think it comes from both the teacher thinking about and getting to experience what has actually been happening in the experience for students. I think you talked about in the last episode with Anand about better, more short form experiences, and which to me as a teacher is like, great, I have more short form experiences, both in and out of headset that I could use that are both multimodal across all experiences, or even in a headset could be multimodal because VR is really good for empathy building and for stage setting. So you could see starting in VR, but then moving into some kind of mixed reality space for more of the discourse. So if we even take that, you know, think, pair, share example, if they're thinking individually, maybe they're thinking in VR. But typically most of that think, pair, share is typically in the pair and the share component of that type of lesson. So I think really distilling down to small short form experiences is really key. And then thinking about from the teacher's hat, they should always be thinking of what's around an experience, whether it's beginning and starting the lesson, whether it's closing out and having some form of formative assessment or closer. But I think, again, as a language teacher, I think there's a lot of opportunity to build those scaffolds in. And I think pre and post and during a lesson. But I think another great example of the ways that developers can think about this that I wish we used more was actually keep talking and nobody explodes. Completely asynchronous experience, right? Where both... I mean, I don't know if everyone's been in it, but you know, if you're a pair or more, you have distinctly different experiences. And it is such an amazing learning tool that I don't think we really recognize, because there has to be language always happening in what I'm describing. If I'm thinking about education, I'm thinking about tier one or tier two and tier three technical language, about what I'm seeing, having to communicate back to someone else and having that conversation. Even early parts of Nano VR and David, the Lighthouse's team over there, had that as a more in-classroom experience. And I was like sold on it. I was like, yes, if students are in the headset exploring something while there's a co-pilot on the computer next to them, that is ripe for learning because of the use of language. Because you can't just say, I see this, I see that, what do you see? You have to be very specific. And so I think if developers teachers are co-designing and thinking about the technology as a tool versus a means to an end, I think you get a lot of ripe variation around what's happening pre, during, and post an experience.
I love your multimodal example where you said jumping, maybe starting in VR and then jumping into, you know, a mixed reality mode where now you can see the physical classroom. Or maybe it's the other way. I've seen now with the Quest 3 headsets and the high quality pass through that we often will start a class, or if it's professional development, a group of teachers in pass through mode. And the feedback we're getting is they're way more comfortable because we haven't gone from 0 to 100 miles an hour. Yes. We basically have gently put the headsets on them. They're not freaked out because they see the real world. They still see chairs and they still see walls. So part of me thinks maybe this is the scalability factor, which is let's start people out with these AR-like experiences inside the headset and then maybe jump after into a VR experience. And so talk to me a bit about that, because I think that was part of your guys' thinking here.
Yeah. So I think you're spot on. And before, because I definitely want to tackle that, I think another great example of a pre and post is what Dreamscape Immersive does, Dreamscape Learn does, where they have students sit in PC VR experiences where there's a narrative contextual setting. It might be 5-10 minutes over the course of, you know, a semester in college, every topic, so every 1 or 2 weeks. And it really does, the narrative pulls you in to want to learn more. And that should not be a thing to dismiss. And I think it's just really powerful. Specifically going back to your question around what we have thought through. So we built out a really small short scene around 360 video, but we wanted to build it as a cooperative experience in which you start in mixed reality. And I think you've seen it where there is a globe. Right now we only have one pin, but we wanted to think about and demonstrate to teachers, schools, students, and specifically the developers, starting in mixed reality and then transporting yourself somewhere, I think is going to reduce the cognitive load for students. I think feels more transformative regardless, and that's going to be subjective, but I do think having that power of going on a shared trip to somewhere, whether that's short form or not, I think is really powerful for students, especially when they're together doing that and can have that type of collaboration and just experience together. I wanted to kind of show and have a little bit more fun around what, we'll just say, launching a 360 video should look and feel like, while making it a little bit more immersive, but it's still coming down to you get to jump into a 360 video, and then, you know, as a developer or eventually, hopefully, an educator can customize that experience for their students. But I think it's to your point, is we wanted to make sure the cognitive load for students is just, that has to be so prescient to a developer, let alone, and I think teachers are very, very aware of this. I don't know if developers are truly aware of that, and why I want us to be a part of adding to that conversation, given all the research that we did internally at Meta, and what I've just heard and done myself. It's just, I think we bias towards kids love games. Games are immersive. All kids play games. All kids don't play immersive games. And so the cognitive load is quite different from playing a phone or tablet game to playing a console game to playing a VR game. And we wanted to think through that from the learning lens. And like you said, have more of a start that is typically less nausea-inducing and has lower cognitive load for everybody. And that includes the teacher and how they build the classroom. They start right away in pass-through mode and they're building their classroom spatially.
Yeah, this term that people throw out there called digital natives really isn't true, because, and I've seen it myself, just because a student spends a lot of time on their phone on social media doesn't make them astute and good at using the mechanics and the UX and the UI inside a VR experience. So you're right, the cognitive load there is real. I want to talk a bit about content. Right now you have a library in beta format, and you've alluded to a few things in there. Walk us through some, you know, the library itself and the fact that there's items in there as suggestions and ideas to give teachers a sense for how Reframe's going to work. But you have big aspirations for this library beyond just what you guys have put in there.
Yeah, I think for us, it was to show teachers how accessible and how you can think more short form that gives you more flexibility during, you know, an average 50-minute classroom across at least middle school and high school. And then for developers to think about different and combined interaction types, whether that is in multiplayer or in single player. So some of our experiences are certainly that static, more observational experience where we can bring in some of those really high quality Smithsonian assets that are just... It's. I've been to the Natural History Museum so many times. It is still awesome to see the woolly mammoth in a classroom when we test. It's weird. I would not expect that because I have seen these things, you know, in real life. But it's just wild to do. So we wanted to say, hey, that is just as valuable. It may not be used as often, although we've been asked by a lot of developers, like, hey, we just want to bring in our 3D content and add some light interactions to it. But I think the point is that is just as valuable as something that is deeply interactive. But as a teacher, you need to, and a developer, you need to think through then what needs to happen for a student during that experience. So if they're observing, then they probably should be talking more about what they're observing and having a lot more discussion in what they're observing, or kind of running through different types of objects that they're seeing. So maybe it is a lot more experiences, but in short bursts. And then we have different experiences. We talked about the climate lesson where you can, I built that one specifically because we were invited to a climate summit last month for a school district. And we wanted to, that's the most you see in that one, is it has objectives, it has standards built into it. And that was to demonstrate, you can have this unique first person perspective of the macro systems of Earth, and you can manipulate the Earth and manipulate different data visualizations on that Earth that I think is just quite unique, doing it in a headset. And you could do it with other people, and that this ups the ante. And then I think the next one, or the last one to really demonstrate, and this is just kind of the idea of sandbox learning or emergent learning, is our the solar system. And there's not a lot of, I will say, learning to it. There's a lot of high interactivity, especially when you have five people manipulating objects all at the same time. It's really meant to be just as much of an accessibility demo for teachers and students, but a technical demo for developers to say, hey, we got your back. We have all this infrastructure built for you. Go ham on the actual content, which is constantly, and still kind of is, and will be for a while, the huge constrictor in the space.
You know, there's this other misconception about what active learning is and isn't. And if you look at the literature and the research, active learning is actually, what are we activating? Thinking. Mm-hmm. So some people think that unless we're using our hands, and like you said, we're fully engrossed in some sort of kinesthetic interaction, that it's not active learning. And if you look at the reading and the research, that's absolutely not true. What we're trying to activate is the thinking. And if, like you said, if it's done right, if some of the lifting in regards to what the teacher wants those students to do around 3D objects that are in front of them, it's still active learning, as long as they're thinking and ruminating and talking about scenarios and situations. I can't help but think, when I was a kid, I remember, and it was an awful learning experience, where we were studying geology and we were learning about different rocks and minerals, and the teacher would bring out the rock kit, except the biggest mistake that she made was she passed it to the first person in the row and she said, look at it. And then you passed it across to your peer. There was no talking about it. I didn't, to be honest, Jonathan, I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. I was like, oh, well, I see a few shiny things. I don't know. And then I just quickly pass it to the next person. There's no learning going on there. So your model and modality is brilliant because you're doing it with groups of people who have some sort of structured idea as to what they need to talk about.
Yeah. And I do think, you know, some of this has lived on for sure prior to us, you know, specifically I think with MergeCube and how they present, you know, objects with, and this is, I think, coming from also Windows's mixed reality toolkit for a while, is having content billboard that's tagged to specific parts of the object. But I still think as a learning experience, it goes way beyond if that object has billboarded content specific to a specific area that tells you, like kind of a museum, right? It's like the learning that happens in a museum is not just the reading of the passage. It is typically the conversation you have with the person with you, if you have someone else, because interpretation can actually be different for other folks, specifically on their lived experiences. And so I think that is where, as a master teacher, you know, of their craft, can come in and say, well, this is what I need to build around it. And that might be out of the headset. Or ideally, developers are getting better with co-designing with teachers and can recognize building that into the experience. And then ideally working with us to say, well, let's pass those, that optionality to teachers from their web portal. So again, they don't have to think about getting in a headset to have part of that conversation or facilitate that from a headset.
I just read a book by Margaret Carrison. She worked for Disney and did a lot of work with some of their installations. And her book it's about immersive storytelling and how you do that well. And one part of her book that I really loved was, she says, in many museums, including Disney exhibitions, you have three people. One is the scholar, and those are the students and the learners that will, like you said, they'll read everything. They're so intrinsically motivated about the topic that doesn't matter. They're there for the long haul. And then there's the stroller. So now you've got partial motivation, and you have to think about the stroller and how you help them out in their journey, whether that's with your app or a museum. And then you have, of course, the far end of the spectrum, which is the streaker. And this is the student that, you know, isn't intrinsically motivated at all. And, you know, she talked about how adding animations and adding, you know, some eye candy to the museum experience or the Disney experience, or in your guys' case, the 3D object, to keep the streaker from running away. So I love kind of your talk there. You mentioned that you're looking at developers. So this app that you're designing isn't necessarily where you guys are going to continue to populate the library. You're leaning heavily on developers, and those might be students, but they could be other vendors that are looking to help bring this library alive into fruition. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, both. Let's talk on both. So specifically with working with other developers, you know, I think it's come from a space of, while at Meta, listening, funding, supporting a bunch of the startups in the space that I think have grown over the past 3 years, and then talking to them now around where their frustrations lie in terms of either their impact or their growth or their retention. And I think everyone comes from a very positive, well-intentioned stance that if you're a believer in this, I want more people to experience it, even if it's not my own stuff, you know, because I think we're still at a point where it's a blue ocean, and helping everybody grow actually helps everybody grow. I think that's really key and important. So from a developer perspective, I heard enough from folks around wanting support and being frustrated with either having their resources split in terms of how they focus on content, infrastructure, platforming, knowing that mostly content is still the hardest thing to build in 3D. And I think generative AI will fix a lot of that things regardless of the potential ethical conversation around that. But from a infrastructural and platform perspective, recognizing that there wasn't and still has not, and I think Reframe is the first true attempt at it, is an LMS that helps you think spatially and thinks about spatial content in a way that can be passed on to the developer to integrate with, and also creates a shared language between developer and teacher who is managing, facilitating, and constantly curating that experience. So we wanted to make sure that we could pass on savings that we learn from schools to developers to help them build, you know, and co-design better experiences, but making sure that those savings are also around the teacher. And so we're really focused on wanting to make sure that developers, whether they are oldies in the space in terms of startups that have been around for a couple of years, they are a lot of folks who are inspired of since the launch last week, a lot of folks have come out and just say, hey, I'm thinking about building this. And I'm like, let's talk. How can we help you? Is I think what has been desperately needed in the space. And then from a student perspective, I'm really glad you brought this up. So because how we're working with developers is a Unity SDK at this time, and eventually we want to work, you know, more WebXR too, because I think that is still the future, in talking to a lot of our partners, they're really heavy into CS. They're really great flagship districts around inclusive CS and wanting to grow the exposure to that. And knowing that this is, I think, because of what Apple has done with spatial computing, is recognizing, oh, if we want to help students who are specifically interested in this track of employment, then we should be thinking about the skills they need. And I got requests from saying, hey, you know, if we're going to get Reframe, can we pass this on to students? And I was like, well, yes, because we control the developer license, and we also control what is seen by teachers if they have licensed, or schools if they have licensed content. That is still a conversation between the school and the developer, but we can actually provide that experience and make it much easier and safer to both upload your app as a student, but then also share that experience both to other students in that school or outside of that school across the school district. I think what is going to be very interesting is if we get to a point where we get to kind of take the, the ability to let students share outside of the school district their experiences. And I think that will probably come when WebXR is better and more easily accessible, stripping away just the idea of downloading an app. But I think being able to give students the ability to share their experiences beyond the school walls or the district walls, I think is super powerful. So we wanted to help the CS community within our partner districts kind of thrive and have faster access to developing with this content. So students will also receive this SDK. They'll be treated as, you know, having a license. But again, the teacher is already probably a pretty adept at Unity is still curating that experience of where, how it lives on the platform and how it gets distributed on the platform. So there's checks and still in balance around the content itself and how it gets accessed by others once the student has developed something that is usable and doesn't break.
I mean, that therein lies the challenge of trying to deploy something that builds a community. And that is the essential question: to what extent can we do that, but still have standards in regards to the quality of content that is in the community library? I know I talked to Anand about this in my last episode, and your thoughts on that? Like you mentioned, there would be some sort of filter or some sort of standard. Have you envisioned that yet, or you're sort of ironing out how that might happen?
I think we're ironing out, but we definitely have thought about it. I think from a library perspective, I actually think more about it in terms of the Clever library, where it is, there are certain technical specifications that you need to adhere to that also then creates a standard language of what schools expect and developers expect from each other. I think, again, that has not existed yet. And that was part of why I wanted to build Reframe, was to start that conversation in a very meaningful and authentic and inclusive way. So from our perspective, we want to, at the beginning, curate a diverse range of content just to demonstrate truly A, how flexible the platform is, but also to help schools realize that this is not just a math machine. It is not just a science machine. There are a ton of experiences that I've seen that I can't even talk about yet that are coming, let alone in just consumer VR, you know, that are more kind of consumer lifelong learning experiences that can be ported to Reframe. And I think should be, because I think they're great educational experiences, but I don't think, I said this to someone, I don't think the technology or the exposure of the technology has helped folks dream enough in terms of what is possible. And I think that does come down to accessibility. I think it just comes down to also just cost in terms of, you know, having a device that I can then experience that allows me to then think about, well, what if this happened? What if I could do this? I don't think we're there yet from an educational lens. And so again, if we bring in the idea of short form experiences, making standard language for developers and schools to talk to each other from a technical and safety perspective, and then thinking about the content that is possible, I just can't wait until we as a community, as an educational community, feel like we can dream even more with this technology. I think that's what I'm most wanting to inspire. And I think that from more of the teacher lens, I think developers have a lot of great, well-intentioned dreams. I always kind of get frustrated with where they start, which is the technology versus going to the teacher first and going, hey, what do you think about this first, and then building it. But going all the way back to the beginning of this conversation around having more teacher leaders in these experiences, leading companies or leading, you know, programs or products within companies, that empathy building has already begun from their experiences as an educator. So it helps them, you know, I think dream faster. So yeah, Reframe is built to help dream faster in a lot of different ways.
I'm going to go down this rabbit hole, even though you warned me slightly. So when it comes to content creation, of course, AI is starting to be talked about a lot. And, you know, we're seeing examples, Luma AI, Sora. So how are your feelings and or thoughts about evolving either as a company or allowing other companies or developers to allow the creation of assets within your library that are AI generated?
I think that is still a conversation to be had by the developer, and, you know, whatever tool they use and then how that tool, you know, attributes folks. I think that's really important. And then what are the rules in place when they work directly with a school, right? We don't want to be that facilitator that of that discussion. I don't think that's required of us. I think we're really just focused on making sure that whatever you do choose that has been agreed upon between you as a developer and the content that you've built and how you built it, and then you, the developer, in your conversation with your school district partner, we're just making sure it's really well performed in terms of the networking and the platform itself. I think for me as an educator, I think there's an interesting line here where I don't quite know, beyond 3D modeling, I don't quite know or feel comfortable where AI as a learning tool is supporting us. And I think that's it's a different conversation, but I think from a 3D model perspective, I love the idea of giving teachers the ability to speak a model to life. Like that just sounds inherently cool. It reduces a ton of friction, which I think is, again, a time saver for teachers, let alone developers. But we go back to our early question is, okay, what are you going to do with that model? And that is where I think there are tools, again, that are lacking in the space that I hope people pick up around authoring tools, where it's like, okay, if I have this model that I just spoke to life, well, what the heck do I do with it? What do I build around it? What type of interaction, audio, animation, like what should come around that? How should a teacher be empowered to do that? I think we're still, I'm thinking like, what is the PowerPoint of VR? I'm like, that still feels like a good 5 to 7-ish years out. I think there are cool stabs around that from a design perspective, thinking about like Bezi and even Shape6R to an extent, I think are great tools for that. And I think from a VR lens perspective, I still think Zoe Immersive helps that in certain ways. But I still think there's a long way to go to think that the majority of teachers will be designing 3D immersive experiences when 99.9% of humans have never experienced VR. Like the gulf there is quite large. So I think if we just continue to take measured steps as an industry and more people take different shots at different parts of the infrastructure and the tooling, kind of like we are, I do think, you know, it's a tide that raises all boats over time.
Mm. What a nice way kind of sum things up and sort of wrap up. There's already been a ton of people, like you said, that are interested since your post a few days ago on LinkedIn. It's just gotten a plethora of responses on that platform, let alone who knows how many through other avenues like email. And so you're on to something, Jonathan, I guess is what I want to say. And so kudos to you. I do see scalability still being a issue for VR. And so I applaud you to be a visionary here, thinking that maybe there's an intermediate baby step that we haven't considered to help teachers figure out how to fit this into what they already know about best practices for teaching and learning. But back to my question, how could people get a hold of you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, you could definitely ping me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active in reaching out and talking to folks. You can come to our website, reframexr.com. You can email me at jonathan@reframexr.com. Just put it out there. Just get in contact with me, whatever you're dreaming or thinking of. I've had all slices of folks pre and post open beta launch. And then lastly, I haven't told this to anyone yet, but I was invited to be on a panel at ASU GSV in this past short week. So I'll be joining the team hosted by Unity, talking about the future of the XR classroom. So come and join that panel. We can talk more of these types of conversations pre and post panel. I'll be there for the majority of that summit. I just want to keep having conversations like these. Because I think we just need to have deeper conversations around the why and the how, and not just the what as a technology. So I'm all for it. Reach out to me.
Well said. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. This was fantastic.